Saturday, September 7th. It was a beautiful day, and after an early morning spent in desultory, unproductive work at the desk and arranging for a trip for the Baileys and the Thomases down into Virginia to Monticello in Charlottesville, the lure of escaping was just too much, and I decided to leave it all and go with them. I said goodbye to Marietta Brooks. She and Max and Robert are leaving for New York later this afternoon. It had been just what I wanted for them, I think, and the emotion and warmth in Marietta's voice filled me with that satisfied sense of having done something for a friend, something that would be cherished. We got a sack of apples and bananas and a box of cookies, and I set out about 11 o'clock with Lucille and her cute little son and Billy and Mary Love for Wakefield, George Washington's birthplace, supposedly about 70 miles down into Virginia. It was a glorious golden day, and the dogwood was just beginning to turn rust and scarlet and its berries bright, the touch of autumn in the air. We stopped at a roadside restaurant, went in, and insisted on having Virginia ham, naturally, which oddly seemed to startle them, but finally it came forth. Salty, sweet, and tasty, one of my lifelong favorite delicacies. There was a little ripple of interest around the room. I could sense people looking at us. As we left, a few children came up and asked for autographs. But it was only a mild interest and pleasant enough. In the bright early afternoon, we arrived at Wakefield, where George Washington was born, and were met by a Park Service man, Bob Walker, who introduced himself as having seen me last in the Big Bend country. We spent over an hour walking around the grounds that slope down to a broad estuary of the Potomac. A mile or so out, you can see the river itself. It's a great flyover in the winter, they say, with lots of geese and swans. The house was made of old brick and sits mellow and substantial on the landscape. It was constructed in 1932 in the depths of a depression by a bunch of very spirited and bold ladies who wanted to do this as a memorial to George Washington. There were no pictures, engravings, and of course no memories, but there was an inventory of the furniture left in the courthouse in some will, and with that and numerous pictures of houses of that time and area, they had constructed this 8-room, simple Georgian structure. There was only one piece of furniture that had definitely been there in young George's time. An interesting thing we heard was that there were still a great many families named Washington on the adjoining land. As we walked, everybody looked at us, and the cameras were busy. And one lady said, "Mrs. Johnson, we're from Oakland, California. We're great fans of your husband. We're sorry he didn't run again." Like so many great old places, this has fallen into the hands of the National Park Service. And just last spring, they had introduced a colonial farm, growing the crops and raising the stock that would have been there between 1730 and 1779 when the house burned. And this proved to be one of the most interesting bits of the day. There was a team of oxen yoked together and pulling an old two-wheel cart, a Negro driver clad in the costume of the middle 18th century directed the oxen around in what was an unknown tongue to me. There was tobacco and corn and pumpkins, but when you get to the animals, it had proved to be quite a project, because so great are the advances in animal husbandry that you can hardly find any stock, any chickens, like there were in the middle 18th century. Mr. Walker explained to us at the chicken yard that indeed, when they began to do research, about all that was left of the same breed were Cornish chickens, game chickens, guineas, but all the big, fat, large-breasted, heavy egg-producing chickens of today are the product of man's scientific breeding, his success stories of the last few decades. So the condition of man, at least materially, in what he raises and what goes on his table, has visibly improved. By now, it was after 3, and entirely too late for them to go on to Charlottesville, we decided, so we'd just spend the rest of the day together and go by Robert E. Lee's home, Stratford. We got lost and were forever finding it. But it was such a pleasant ride across the back roads of Virginia in the bright early autumn that nobody minded. I was particularly enjoying being with Lucille. We hadn't been together this much since we were children and waded in the cool streams at Billingsley and climbed Hog Mountain and went on hay rides and to watermelon cuttings. She is slim, her eyes sparkle. She is animated and seems happy enough The painful divorce is behind her. A delightful woman took us through Stratford, which is 200 years old, having housed the Lees for 100 years, and after them, some Lee kinfolk, the Stuarts, for another 100. Only in the early 1930s, been purchased by another brave group of women, this time a chapter of the UDC, located, amusingly enough, in Yankee Land, in Greenwich, Connecticut. I had not been to Stratford since we used to go with a speaker. It must have been 20 years ago or more. More of the rooms are furnished. The great, solid, fortress-like architecture is just as I remembered it. Cross ventilation, such practical, pleasant engineering. The most memorable object to me, a cradle, beautifully draped, which had been used by Robert E. Lee, we were told, and had returned to this house from Natchez, Mississippi. We reached the White House a little past 6, and I found Lyndon at the lunch table. He'd put in a long, busy day, almost cleared his desk, and was having soup and dessert. Then he lay down for a little rest, and I went to the bowling lanes with the Baileys, had 3 games. Lucille turned out to be an expert, and Julian, too, and Sweet Mary Love, the comic relief. The Pickles and Deasons and Jack Brooks alone came in for dinner. The MacHughes joined us for dessert at the table. Everybody had been to the Texas picnic, which had been in honor of Marvin, and we felt a pang of regret, actually, that we hadn't gone. But it is not possible, really, to have a personal, relaxed, natural time in a crowd. It turns out to be a show, a front, a sort of giving. It was a pleasant, happy day, and yet there was a sense of sadness, of stagnation, of no progress for me. Yesterday, we had received a letter from Gardner Ackley, declining, with many thanks, the opportunity to head the School of Public Service. I had called Chancellor Ransom to remind him of 2 names that had appeared earlier on the list, Walt Rostow and Gail McGee. He had been strong for either of them, but he himself is not on the faculty committee. He would look into it. He would be in touch with me by the middle of next week. And so, in the days of this fall, many things are winding up, and it is a time that calls for strength and determined fighting for anything that can be achieved, for good cheer in the face of everything.